JJ Kadosh.
I suspect, you know, the MIT president had at least a doctorate. So, Rosenthal, I think I've got the name right, I used to know, but my memory's 23. So he went to Arnold and said, look, there's no way you're going to get 200,000 pilots that you want. But, you know, we have developed testing in this country to the extent that we can find out the IQs of people and all kinds of aptitudes and whatever that they have. So let's go ahead and put together that scheme, and that's the way we'll get our pilots. So here I was one of these people in 42, late 42. I finally had enough of being a civilian and had to get into this conflict and wanted to fly. So I go off to the recruitment. This was at Indiana, Pennsylvania. And I said, you know, I want to enlist. And the fellow says, no, you can't enlist. We just move people up in the draft now. I said, okay, move me up. What do you want to do? I said, I want to get into the Air Corps. I want to become a pilot. He said, no, you don't want to do that. I said, what? What do you mean I don't want to do that? He said, we've got potential pilots all over Indiana County waiting to be called in. No, he said, what you want to do is go into the regular Army and then transfer from the regular Army to the Air Corps. Okay, so I end up down at Camp Pickett, Virginia, in a basic training to become a medical corpsman. And after a week or so, I went to see the captain, and the first sergeant said, what do you want? And I said, well, I want to move to the Air Corps. And he said, oh, you don't have to see the captain. I'll arrange this. He said, you'll get a call within the next week, which I did. Went up to Langley Field and spent a whole day up there with 60 others being tested from stem to stern, as you might guess. Physical, mental, and all that sort of stuff. 20 of us passed the test. We got transferred to the Air Corps. I forgot to mention that I dropped out of high school my junior year. So, here I was, a non-high school graduate, on my way to become a navigator or a pilot or something. We'll see what they do with me. Well, eventually, first I got sent up to Syracuse University, where they were doing some training with us. And then finally, after more testing and what have you, I got sent off to Clarksdale, Mississippi to hopefully become a pilot, which I was successful in doing. And I might mention, I was one of the first people to solo out of 100. So I moved on to second phase of flying, and my instructor thought I was one of the most gifted people he'd ever flown with, which was very flattering. And he said, of course you're going to single engine. I said, no, I'm going to twin engine. He said, you're not going to twin engine, you're going to single engine. Well, after a great deal of prompting and what have you, he finally became convinced I was going to go to a twin engine. And he wanted to know why. I said, well, this war's going to last forever, and I'll get a chance to fly a commercial if I want to. Well, I'll jump the story and maybe fill you in the details later on, but I did get an offer from American Airlines later on to fly. But that's enough. I'll answer any questions later on.
Okay, Carl.
That's about it. The last one I had was wrapped around for 2 hours and 45 minutes yesterday, so anyway, as I recall, finally got called in, I enlisted at the old post office in Ottawa, Chicago, and passed everything to become an aviation cadet. And went back home to my job running a service station, waiting to test that time in 43. Not quite what I was talking about in 1942. They still didn't have enough places to train everybody. And so I waited up to almost June of that year of 42 to get the call and head for Tennessee. a new training base in Tennessee. Congressman, one congressman from Tennessee has sold the Air Corps about 2,000 or 3,000 acres of land for this new operation. Nice brick buildings, everything first rate, except they didn't have any water. And he drank out of a Lister bag at your hut. And we ate in the field all the time when I was there, you know. Most of the guys in the new time would wind up in the big barrel with the stuff when they got done. But anyway, from there we were went through the process of what were you going to be, a pilot or a navigator? Or, anyway, I came out as a bombardier, and in short order, we were on a train headed for New Orleans, and from New Orleans we went up Route 6 on a slow boat to China. It took 2 weeks. By the time we got to California, we were going up nothing but orange groves up to what was it, big 53. He had 50,000 other cadets there at that time. And after I went through that experience, I went to New Mexico, got my bombardier's rating there. The last 2 weeks I helped out as to help fly with others to help pass them. And from there they sent me on to Texas to navigation school, supposedly to get a double rating for the B-29s that were beginning to be developed. And from there, waited until I got the call to head for Washington. Eufrata, Washington, the first base, and I gave the office there in Eufrata was a wooden hut on four wheels. And he nice, said the door open to me. I handed my orders, and he handed me another order to head for second. I'm sorry, head for second phase right away. So everything was pretty fast going, you know, two different places in Washington where we trained the T-17s, and wound up in the mountains up in Oregon for the third phase, and on from there, you know, we headed for the east, and matter of fact, the colonel that was head of our unit, we ran into a lot of storms on the way going east. We landed at Buffalo, New York, and they landed right in front of us. And he put one of his wheels went off into the mud. And so the pilot was flying co-pilot with the colonel. The co-pilot was sleeping back in the back end of the ship. And he got out of the plane to see what he could really wrong. In fact, he was from New York in the first place. And he walked right into the whirling prop. And that's as far as he got. Anyway, on we went to Gander, Newfoundland, and took off. We took off after about the end of the week for England, and it was a tail end of a hurricane, and the clouds were just about the height of this ceiling here. So five of us got off as we had pulled up our wheels when the order came, you can't come back, but nobody's going any further. You know, we had about 15 planes at that point. And our, our nearest help was Goose Bay, Labrador, so it was an easy flight. I was awake all the way, looking for a shot to take. Once in a while, it's like a little hunk of the moon. They had George running the plane, more or less. Everybody had sandwiches, coffee, and that. They didn't think of little old me. So by the time we got to England, we were running in a dense fog, and they said nobody's landing here today. And all the boys were saying, we're out of gas, you know. And so the pilot asked me, where could I get a safe heading? And I told him, head for Stornoway, Scotland, up that's the very tip where the people coming in from the north. And I, boom, I fell asleep right on the desk there. And nothing more happened until I got it. They were yelling at me. And I said, what's the matter? And they said, we're getting a radio signal that's 1 degree off from the one you gave us. They said, well, we did cross the date line here. I could be 1 or 2 off, you know. Anyway, we went to Stornoway, Scotland. And it was of my first trip to the British Isles, and it was quite a revelation for the loo. We had to stay overnight. We went to the town meeting house. And they were having a dance there. They were having a dance there. I shouldn't get into the little niceties of what happened. It was very primeval. So anyway, we left the next day to wound up in Stone, England, and we got a week or two of training there. It was fine that the first thing they said that, now the first thing you should remember is you're dead. And they said, at that time, 5% were finishing up. So anyway, I did have one thing to my credit. Everywhere we landed, we were always in barbed wire. We couldn't get off the base. But when I got in the second place, I got a telegram from my brother, and I had to get something out of the post office, so I was mailed off the base, and it was a check. I mean, it was a money order that they were sending me, and so I did a thing for the troops. I stopped off at a forgive me, I have these black things that come across my head. A place like Walgreens, only it was pretty old. And I walked into the building, there's a table there of everything was on sale. Oh, silk stockings, lipstick, a couple other items that the boys would all like to take. Oh, I'm the only guy that's allowed a suit. It's not a suitcase. A container. Okay, it had all the navigation books and stuff that you don't read anymore anyway. So I had a lot of room for. Oh, and I stopped to buy liquor. And at that time, there was no good whiskey left there. There was wine, all the wine you wanted, but no. And I walked in about the fourth bar, and he said no whiskey, and I. leaned over the bar and I saw a gal with Jim Beam sitting down there on the floor. And in those days, all the taverns would have a big bottle that they would empty. And then they'd have a party. You'd drop change and stuff and we'll have a bar party. So I said, no, I wanted that. I just want to say that to tell you this. When I was walking out there with the bag from the one store and the gal in the other arm, Air Corps soldiers didn't like the salute, okay? And any amount that were on the street made a point of coming up to me and saluting me. Well, anyway, that was, we got that to the plane, we got that over to Stone, England, and when we went into Stone, they said, just leave your stuff behind. We'll have these circus tents, and if you find one of your crew in there, all your crew will be there. They're about a half of them. And the next morning, when we walked into those tents, it was ripe with wild whiskey, you know. So I didn't have too much hope, and everything came out okay. Now, I didn't get much to use out of it myself, because after about 2 or 3 weeks of training at the 306, my first mission was Bremen. And that was enough to open your eyes. I'm trying to think of his name. Same name as Bing Crosby's name, but he was the lead of the 100. Not only did he go through one 25 mission, but he went through a second 20. He did a double duty, and he. He said, the only mission he was ever scared of was when he went to the Bremen. Because it was loaded with fighters and it was loaded with flak. Anyway, when we got back from that mission, when I stepped out of the plane and I looked up from front to back, it looked like a colander. There was nothing but holes from the tail to the nose. And I was so surprised that nobody was hit. Well, I got one flak in the back of my left hand. I was wearing a flak suit. Yeah, flak was. Matter of fact, during earlier that week, our captain of the base, he took care of not flying personnel. He came onto the stage and said, boys, he held the flak suit in his hand. He had the 45 up and he said, we want you to start wearing these now. They'll take a good view. And anyway, he knocked the 45 into his flak and he said, a little bent, but it was okay. Somebody looked behind me and said, "UOBALE, you know what? Why don't you wear it yourself?" He said, I will if I ever get the chance. Well, fine. Ground personnel were allowed to fly missions, you know. They had other duties. I wound up playing cribbage with him within a couple of months because he went down one day after I went down. All these guys. When I got that's later on. Early the next morning, we were headed for the longest ride of the year. We were headed for the Polish quarter. And so commissioners seem to always say, you took off and you made your turns and turns, and as you picked up more units, and said, when you finally had all the necessary ones, then you took off, go across the channel. And you get about halfway across the channel, maybe a little farther, and you look up, and there's your fighter help making a U-turn going back home, and coming the other way was the whole German Air Force, okay? And then they followed you all in and all the way out. So I guess we were very lucky at Brown. But we got a replacement plane from the one that they jumped out, that went ahead, a Calder. And we got another much older 17. It had to be older, but it did have one thing. It had a chin turret and nothing else up in front, except the top turret. None for me, okay? And it was a long ride. It was long. After we made the turn, we were getting lost. We couldn't keep up with the rest of them. Everybody was headed for home, full speed. And then the fighters were still following us, but they had no trouble with us because we got farther and farther behind. So by the time we got over the Baltic, we had one engine on fire, and they were having a free time taking turns at us. So we were fortunate to the plane was fired, was going down, we bailed out over Samso was the island. And it was a little, but you know, like a guard aisle. It was about 17 miles long and about 5 miles wide. Yeah, what do we get there on the ferry, either from Jutland or Copenhagen. So we all bailed out but one. We lost one of the original crew, one of the waste gunners, nice young man from Michigan. And I only saw one of my crew when I landed, and it was a radio operator, and he had broken his leg. So I hauled out gave him a shot of painkiller. And by that time, Black Mariah showed up with a dozen of German Kriegsmarines. It was an island that was a base for the German Kriegsmarines. And so I just see the rest of my guys who were scattered from one end to that island to the other. And so I spent the night in the chicken coop. And there's a lot of farming going on there, see? And they posted a guard on me, and that was it. Of course, by the way, I didn't have my mask the day before leaked, and I had a first class headache by the time we got back to the base. And it was a very short sleep of about 4 hours before they called you get you started out the next morning. I didn't eat when I got back, didn't make much difference. And then they came, so here it is about five o'clock or so, maybe six, well, the lady from the farm walked up, opened up the door, walked by the guard, and she had a little wicker basket with a doily on it, and she had a piece of chicken and a couple of potatoes for me. So that was it. And so by the next morning, who arrived? But a but a captain, a Hauptmann, and he's a submarine captain. Got a, the old college dueling star on his face. And he's got a crew of four to take me over to the main island of Copenhagen. Okay. And the seas were pretty rough that day. And I was down in the hold with the four German guards. And every one of them lost one TV. And the sailor really thought it was something funny. That stuff never bothered me, because if you ever flew those small two-engine planes in training in Texas at about 2,000 feet or 3,000 feet, you were up and down on the length of breadth of Texas, you know. But anyway, so when I got there, when I got to the island, it was the first big city, not the island, before you get to Copenhagen. And if you know Denmark, it's just a myriad of islands. We brought me up to the first class hotel, because when I went to the lobby, they had a guy in a tux playing the piano. I thought it was probably they were going to have high tea or something, you know, crumpets. But he brought me up to the fifth floor, and by that time, our engineer was with us. Now, that poor guy, he had all his lower teeth removed. Well, going from one place to another, he had a lot of food. And we went to the colonel, the major, the doctor, in our group. And we said, we can't take this guy with us. He hasn't got his teeth. He said, yeah, but we'll catch up with him. We've taken the stuff. Never did catch up with him. And then there he's up there doing the top turret. Clamp your teeth down, he's going to have trouble. So anyway, poor guy was with me. They didn't find him. They had him up there with me. And so he said, the captain said to me, he said, as an officer, he said, if you give me your word you won't try to escape, I'll give you a free run of the town. I said, I can't do that. My route is to escape. But my friend said, sir, he said, I've got a 10th spot in my shoe. Now, I'm in a baby blue electric suit. Now, God bless my other thing stepped up over me. Oh, well, I got a pair of shorts and undershirt, and that's it. And no money, I left everything behind, of course. I wouldn't give them anyway. But he said, I can go to a chemist and get a razor blade. You guys are kind of scratchy. He said, I'll get a razor blade, a little wire soap for you. So, first of all, gave me the 10 bucks, and about an hour and a half later, he came back with a little bar of soap and a piece screw in double-edged razor blades. So I'm sure he pocketed that 10 spot for future, you know. Anyway, from there, I wound up meeting two of the Luftwaffe, a sergeant and a private. The private had a big suitcase on his shoulder that he was a strapping big young man. Our group had been 3 weeks before that bombing his hometown. But anyway, Anyway, they walked me across. We walked across Copenhagen from one side to the other on the main route, right back by City Hall with the biggest flag about the size of that wall, the Nazi flag flying with the Wehrmacht with a rifle standing about 50 feet each away from the, they were having their Black Mariah fires there. And, you know, they're occupied, and they have a lot of they had friends, but they had a lot of resistance there, and they were burning a lot of automobiles and everything else. And from there, I got on, they took me over into two air bases, made fun of me, and two ATAC officers saw me with my suit on and my name, and then they started looking at each other, they started calling their names as though they had the same names on there. But anyway, onto another truck, to a base. We stopped off at a farmyard on the way. First time I ever saw. One guy got out, came back with a bushel of wood, and fed the car. The car was a wood burner. So, you know, all kinds of things you see. And from there to a ferry, to a train to Berlin, and spent a night there with the. In their USO with a bowl of potato soup. From there to Dulag Luft for interrogation for about a week. And from there on a 48-day train and headed for it, we didn't know where. Wuhlen guys and everybody else, everybody who had to stand up, there was no place to sit down. We must have had almost 100 guys in one car. And two to three days later, we wound up in Poland, Stalingrad 3. That there was my vacation place for the next 19 months. Yeah. So until the Russians came through, we went on a long walk, minus 20. Left at just at midnight, we left for our march. But when I had arrived there, it was a half British camp, or a little bit more than a half British camp, because there was a war ahead of us, a lot of from the LMA and whatnot. And each hut was divided with a door in the middle, and so we had one side. And the British had the other. And after about three or four months that I was there, they moved the British, all the British, to the North Camp. We had five camps at Stalingrad, three, and all camps were separated one from another. Theirs was the greatest, was the camp with the Great Escape. And they suffered for it too, because they lost about 50 guys that they executed when they caught them. And they had started one in they had already started one in the center compound, which was the oldest camp in the base. And so our people, we finished it off. But the thing was, about 4 months before the Great Escape, I was standing security in front of the, almost alongside the tunnel in Block 44. And all of a sudden I saw German guards coming in, and I didn't understand why the head goon was coming in. Turns out the gentleman from Sweden, the envoy from Sweden that took all the camps, was visiting Stalingrad 3, so they're putting on a smile on their face to say how nice they treated us, you know. And so we had a lot of, if you wanted to escape, you had to get in line. because you had to get the line by the day that you got there. It's a line of, in that type of line. Plus, they wanted you to speak two languages. Plus, you had to have a good plan. They went for the escape money, so I was helping out, watching security for them. So we were deprived of bread for a good solid month. Now the bread was black bread, weighing 2 kilos a loaf. And that's about 5 pounds, you know. And so in comes a truck, loaded up to the top of the truck with black bread, pulling a trailer with black bread. And I'm holding my breath as it crosses the tunnel. Oh, it's going to be the night of our escape. And it pulled across finally with the front wheels. But when the back wheels came over, they kind of started to sink a little bit. So he put it in reverse. And as he moved back and forth, down those wheels went. And the head dude was there, and he called for the hose. And we got a pool there, a kind free washer for fire. So they pumped those wheels down, and that sand went plop, 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 all the way out through the fence on the other side. So you would think, seeing wherever that started, that they would be alerted for any other, and yet it was the same type of tunnel that was the North Campus, the Great Escape. Okay.
Wow.
So for the grace of God, that could have been us, mm-hmm. You know. So that was that. All our rations were cut back. We even had already started saving stuff for Barth. And it was a long haul. We got the news every day, the news from the Germans and the news from our news, and we just split the middle because, both were somewhat exaggerated. More of them sold by the Germans. And
I think we'll need to stop because we're going to run out of time because we've got to go into the banquet. So if we have some additional questions for Carl, we'll come back to him.
You mentioned Carl's 96.
Yeah, Carl's 96 years old. So why don't you get down and give me about 10 push-ups?
I'll bet he can.
Okay, if you'll pass that over to Grover.
I'll be glad to.
And we'll try to get all three. There you go.
There you go.
Excuse me, man. Did you say that Paul is 90 years old?
No, no.
No, he's 96 years old.
No, I'm 95.
Well, I'm over 90 also.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure that I haven't been led into a trap. And I'd like to talk 1 second with my doctor daughter in order we might shorten this thing.
Okay.
Tell them about...
That's why I didn't want to do it the last time.
You did a good job, thank you.
Yeah, you did a great job.
It made me want to ride a motorcycle with Steve McQueen.
I don't like the lack of showing that part.
Well, I was hoping that Carl was going to get into his time as a POW.
Okay.
I don't know anything too colorful or outlandish to tell you, and I don't want to stand up here. I'm an old lawyer who all used to get paid for talking.
So what you're saying is if we'll pay you, you'll talk.
Right,
okay, let's pass the hat around. Let's pass the hat around.
So anyway, I don't have anything to say.
Well, we may have some questions for you.
I'm glad to be here with these people.
All right.
Don't leave. Have a seat. And we may have a question for you. Grover was, as I said, a gunner. Well, Grover is too modest because, you know, I've been traveling across England for 12 years interviewing the British people, and everywhere I go, all these former British girls keep asking about it. I don't know what that's all about. I don't know what that's all about, but they asked for him by name, so something about Piccadilly Commandos or something, I don't know.
Now, if that were only true. All of them.
Yeah. You know, lawyers talk for a fee. Research historians will write books for a fee. So if Grover was to give me enough money, I can write some lies about him and do a book, and he will come out like Clark Gable. In fact, I can put him in there with Clark Gable.
Well, what?
Okay, questions.
I would like to know. I know that, Grover, you got to Thurlow the 9th of May of 44, and when did you finish up your tour?
When did I finish what?
Your tour?
I've got a hearing problem also.
No.
Let me knock this thing up for you. No, I'm all right. It's not the talking, it's my hearing.
It's going by what's in the car. When did you get to Thurlow, and when was your tour over?
I got to Thurlow. I made my first trip there on May the 8th, 1943.
Oh, okay.
Four.
And, huh?
44.
44? Thank you. now I got my daughter in there. Anyway, I finished up the same year.
How long?
No, as I say, I was waiting on the Queen Elizabeth, yeah, to take me back to the United States. And somebody came from the same field, the 306 bomb group. Somebody came from the same field a few days later and said, "Did you know your old plane had got shot down?" And I said, "No, I didn't," but I said, "It's time to go home."
Yep.
So that would have been September or October of the same year.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Grover. Any other questions? Back here in the back, Cliff.
Yeah, Mr. Gadosh, you were flying missions when the war ended. What did it feel like on the day that you found out? I mean, were you scheduled to fly toward the end? What was it like around the field?
Well, number one, of course, when we got over there, they took us out, what we call flub dubbing, looking over.
Can you repeat that?
That's for him.
It's for him. It's my hearing, not my...
The question is for him.
Not my loud mouth. Okay,
the question was for him.
He was asking a question. We're taking questions from the audience.
Well, I understand that, but I'm not hearing them.
Okay.
I must need it. Maybe you all leave me, make time to change batteries up here or something.
Okay.
All right, so I'm away.
Take time to do that.
Yeah.
Okay.
You all excuse me just a minute.
Sure.
After, I think, about 4 days of being shown what landscape was around there, and of course they're getting to know who we were. When I say we, there were three crews came over: Bob Grace, his crew, and Elder Romanin and myself. And it must have been about the fifth day, you know, at about 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, somebody shaking me, "Lieutenant, we got you flying." And I said, "You don't even know where the hell I'm living," because I wasn't sure I knew where I was living at the time yet. Anyway, you know, they announced breakfast at 4:30, 5 o'clock, and briefing and on and on and on. So, did all that. When I got to the plane, I found out that I had an experienced co-pilot, Mike Michaels by name, who had flown 21 missions.
Wow.
And so, he joined me. One of the first surprises I got is we pulled out, getting in line to go to take off. The plane, of course, functioned very differently than what I had known. I had never been in an Air B-17 that had, 2,800 gallons of gasoline and the bombs and all that sort of stuff. It was sluggish. finally got to take off, and again, I mean, you look, you see the end of the runway, and this thing is just crawling, and you're saying to yourself, I've heard people don't make it. I'm wondering if this damn thing is going to get off the ground or not. But it, sluggish, 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 and all the controls were sluggish because I wasn't accustomed to all this weight. Finally, get down to the end and pull the airplane off of the runway, and again, surprise, surprise, it was like flying a brick. I've been accustomed to really feeling what was going on. This was very, very different. And as you could guess, whatever, you know, turn, and finally join the group and start formation flying. Again, you have to learn how to fly formation all over again because you've never flown anything this heavy and unusual. So that was the initial experience of taking off and joining a group, learning how to fly all over again.
What do you remember about the last mission you flew?
Well, I'll tell the second one rather than the last one. In that, as we were in bomber stream, must have been about, you know, 10, 12,000 feet, I found myself feeling very good. Here I was, 20 years of age, and as I mentioned, a non-high school graduate. Flying this B-70, something that I look forward to doing, you know. I had joined specifically to get involved in what was going on. And so I looked up ahead, 36, 36, 36, 36, 36, 36, was in a bomber stream, turned my back, 36, 36, 36, 36, 36. I was in a bomber stream of about 1,000 B-17s. That can be humiliating. I said, hell, I'm just another jockey. That's all. There are 2,000 pilots like myself flying that day.
Amazing.
And I also knew in the back of my mind that there was probably about another 1,000 B-17s and B-24s coming up from Italy. And we'd get, you know, 3,000 fighters over us and a couple of thousand fighters over them. This was quite an experience. But I should mention, I suppose, a little more. So we got to about 14 or 15,000 feet, and Mike Michaels began swearing a blue streak. I said, what the hell's wrong, Mike? He said, take a look at the instruments on number three. Well, I was flying formation, so I looked over. Oh, no. All the dials are going down. All the dials are going down. Boom. I said, well, I guess I have to feather this engine, which I proceeded to do. Now we're trying to keep up in the bomber stream, and we're having trouble. Michael said, hey, we got to go back home. So got out of formation, and we're heading for home. And again, Michael's beginning swearing a blue streak. I mean, he could really swear. I said, what the hell's wrong, Michael? He said, are you aware, JJ, we get home, they unfeather this engine, there's nothing wrong, we get court-martialed? Ooh, no, I wasn't aware of that. So I said, wait a while. Quickly, I thought, it's only been a minute or two that around the formation, that oil would not have congealed. I said, I'm gonna unfeather the engine. So I hit the button, the engine starts up, all the dials go to normal. What the hell's going on? Don't know. But anyway, then we said, wait a minute, let's see if we can join the bomber stream and, you know, go off to combat. So we found an outfit, joined them, turned, and they were flying terrible formation. I mean, we were way down at the bottom, as you could guess, because we joined them. And we're going 170 miles an hour, and then they're staggering all over the skies, and we're going 120 or so. And finally, Michael said, give me the damn airplane. I'm going to go to the other side because I was flying formation. So he took off and went around. No more than got in position, and we looked up, and here comes another bomb group straight at us. Kind of where we were, could see the planes were fighting to try to avoid crashing. Three of them stalled out. Down they go like bricks. I didn't see anybody come out, chutes, and crew members, Mike Bruce said they didn't see anybody. Maybe at the bottom they got out, finally got out of the dive. Otherwise, all three had perish completely. So that was number two.
Any other questions? Or we can do it in Spanish. ¿Hay preguntas? Have we got him fixed to where he can hear? Can you hear, Grover?
Yeah, I finally got it.
Okay.
All right.
Come on back up here. I have a question for you.
Well, for instance, in referring to the other remark here a few minutes ago, it seems that they were trying to keep me out of trouble and not let me in. So, anyway, I don't have anything to say. Go ahead and ask.
Well, it's about these girls. No, it was... I just wondered if on all your missions, if there was one that stood out in your mind as being the most memorable mission.
Well, there have been several of them. The first mission was to Berlin.
Take this.
Okay. I figured they could hear me without it.
No.
But anyway, the first one was to Berlin. That was May the 8th, 1944. And we had an incident where the person who was flying as first pilot on that occasion, he had been the co-pilot on the crew flying next to us. And he was doing a remarkably good job, and right over Berlin, his old plane, his crew, was flying beside us. And it took a bad lick there right over the town and went down. I expect that for the rest of his life, he was wondering, Lord, why me? And there have been some others. There were, I took pictures every once in a while when I was up in the air. I took it with an old 35mm camera that I'd had. And they said, you're not supposed to take a camera with you. I said, nobody told me that. And so I took it along lots of times, and I noticed that I lent some of the negatives to the navigator, and after the war, he got a request for information from someone in England who wanted to write a book about the 305th bomb group. And I told him it's all right with me, and lo and behold, they sent me a copy of one chapter of a book which I don't know whether he published or not, but he wrote it. And he put the pictures in there, and one of them, of course, shows this B-17 going down in a pile of smoke. And they were good pictures. And I told him I didn't have any objection to him using them if he wanted to, and so I have that. And our navigator, Stevenson, could never agree with him as to what mission this was, not based on that one picture. And I have it, and I don't know. I mean, I didn't make, you know, remarks about the pictures which I took, and I didn't take them for personal gain or anything like that. I just took them to be taking them and for my own use. And I've been told that I should have destroyed them years ago because they were made out of some sort of film which had a high voltage power when it came to fire. So anyway, I'm glad to be here with you all.
Any other questions? Well, thank you very much. And
I'll give you that last mission.
Okay, well, last mission.
The last mission was kind of interesting. I dropped leaflets on Munich, and the leaflets read, they were in Russian, English, and German,
stay here, the war is about over, and you will begin to receive food and what have you. Yeah. But what's interesting about it is they were sent eight P-51s as cover for us, and we went in alone at about 1,000 feet. It was very comforting to look out in the back and see four fighters on each wing. But the other interesting thing is, well, you opened up the Bombay doors, we were right smack in the middle of Munich, and there was a big crowd of people there. Honest to God, I thought I heard a gasp, not again.
No.
And this big bomb drops out, and I mean, they must have been terrified, and the thing explodes, and there are leaflets in it. So I think I may have dropped the last bomb on Munich, but unfortunately, I don't think it hurt anybody.
Well, thank you very much. We have the dinner starting at 6:30, gather around. I think that's going to be in the room next door. Mm-hmm. And so you can spend the rest of the time looking at the exhibits, talking, getting ready. Huh. And we'll see you at the First Over Germany dinner.
Cocktails in 10 minutes.